Welcome to the Water Entrepreneur Podcast. This program features a series of interviews exploring the origin stories of startup founders, early adopters, and innovation champions related to their personal, technical, business, organizational, and financial journeys. This podcast is sponsored by Astera, the leader in remote Earth observation technology for the water business. Support is also supplied by Imagine H2O, envisioning and building solutions with the world's best water entrepreneurs. And now, live from beautiful downtown Encinitas, your host, Paul Gagliardo. Welcome and thanks for joining me today. This is episode 10 of the Water Entrepreneur Podcast, and I'm your host, Paul Gagliardo. And today I'm very pleased to have as my guest, Julie Mullen. She's the co-founder and CEO of Aclarity, developing and deploying modular electrochemical treatment systems to destroy contaminants such as PFAS in liquid waste. Hi, Julie. Thanks for being a water entrepreneur and joining me today.
Hi, Paul. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, there are many hazardous chemicals that are persistent in the environment and accumulate in the blood or fatty tissues that have significant negative health effects. DDT was first, the first modern synthetic insecticide developed in the 1940s. I remember growing up on Long Island in the early 60s, and we would run around outside and be sprayed with DDT when they were spraying for mosquito control back in the day. Little did we know, right? Rachel Carson's book in 62, The Silent Spring, brought attention to pesticides poisoning wildlife, and EPA finally banned DDT in 1972. PFAS were invented in the 30s by DuPont, and DuPont even documented low-dose exposure caused negative health effects from these chemicals in the 1960s. EPA was first alerted to these risks in 1998, but it took until 2021 for EPA to announce it would develop drinking water and wastewater discharge standards. Why do you think it takes so much time for health regulators to take actions on chemicals that are known to have to be hazardous, have negative health effects?
That's a great question. Back before I started Aclarity, I worked at the US EPA in Boston in the drinking water unit. It's a really wonderful place. And this is where I first heard of PFAS. Back then they were called PFCs. And so, I have some experience there on the regulatory side. And I've also seen it on the perspective of the users and the storers of PFAS. You can't dispute that PFAS are harmful. They're soon to be regulated under CERCLA, PFOA and PFOS is specifically under CERCLA as hazardous, which is quite crazy. And we can get into that in a little bit, but I think a lot of it comes down to the ability to measure compounds. Specifically PFAS, because now we're talking not even parts per billion, not even parts per trillion, but the new health advisors came out in the parts per quadrillion. we can't even measure parts per quadrillion, and especially those low parts per quadrillion. So a lot of it comes down to analytical methods. EPA has some pretty good analytical methods, but they certainly need some work. And then the other part of it is on the regulatory side is who's going to enforce it, and who's going to pay for it, right? The other part about regulating chemicals or contaminants in the environment is that U.S. regulatory framework is convoluted, and we have these chemicals being, and chemicals in general, right, being regulated at the federal level in different parts. So there's the Safe Drinking Water Act, there's now coming CERCLA, there's all these different parts of EPA, there's even outside of EPA in the legislature. And then you have states, and the individual states to have their liberty to regulate contaminants, how they feel in drinking water and wastewater and permits and all around cleanup standards. And you get even deeper at the municipalities and at the regionalized locations. So just even from that long-winded answer, it's like it's so difficult to regulate. Who's responsible? How are we going to pay for it? How are we going to detect it? You know, how are we going to enforce it? I think that's why it takes so long.
Interesting. And it seems like these industrial chemical companies, as they develop something new that they find works, you know, for whatever reason, insecticide, pesticide, whatever it happens to be, they're the ones that end up doing additional work to identify whether or not they're hazardous. I mean, you know, just think about, you know, the tobacco companies, you know, it's the same kind of thing. They knew a long time ago, you know, that it was hazardous, but they're like, you know, we don't want to tell anybody, you know, because that's going to ruin our whole business model. And so, there, you know, it's an interesting dynamic about, you know, whether or not it's in this company's best interest to notify anybody, you know, that there's some kind of negative health effects. And that just takes a long time to kind of work that through the whole system. So what exactly are PFAS and what are they used for?
Yeah, so PFAS stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. I never expect anybody to remember that. but they're a class of chemicals, and they're characterized by their very strong carbon and fluorine bond. So there are small chains and large chains of these PFAS compounds, but that carbon-fluorine bond is the strongest bond known in nature. It's almost impossible to break. McClarty's found a way to break those bonds, but that's what makes them called the forever chemical. You know, as you mentioned, they're Teflon chemicals. They are really good at things like fire retardants, and you know, they're found in firefighting foams and all over. You know, I look around and I see there's probably PFAS on the majority of the things that I can see in my office. they're very good at what they do. I guess going back to the previous conversation, another one of the reasons why they have been so difficult to regulate too is that they do a really good job at what they're intended to do, and so finding alternatives is quite difficult as well.
When I was working on direct potable reuse back in the 1990s, people were concerned about what they called endocrine disruptors. And that was really a misnomer, because the class of compounds were really, would be better described as hormone mimicking compounds. And you had mentioned that PFAS are called forever chemicals. Do you think that's really a valid moniker for these chemicals, or is it just kind of a way to describe, you know, their persistence and that, you know, they are a significant issue that should be dealt with? Do you think it's more political, I guess, or more technical, a way to describe these compounds?
That's a really great question. I think it's a combination of the two. As you're explaining that, I'm saying, shaking my head, yes, that's right. And then you go to the answer, yes, that's right. I think it's the both, right? They're so strong, they bioaccumulate in your blood, right? 98% of Americans have PFAS in their blood, which is pretty terrifying. You know, their carbon fluorine bonds are so hard to break. They persist in the environment. They persist, you know, everywhere. I think, though, calling them forever chemicals has resonated with people, even the non-scientific and the non-policy people, consumers in general. Now, if they hear of the forever chemical, like chemical in itself has a negative connotation. You put forever in there and it starts to resonate. And I think this PFAS movement is one of the big ones, especially in our lifetime, where public perception has just elevated the need to do something about these forever chemicals. And to your point, perhaps it's their nickname, forever chemicals, that's doing that.
Well, I think that it's always important to get attention to place a label on things. When, as I mentioned, I was working in indirect potable reuse, essentially making sewage into drinking water. And the editorial board of the local newspaper nicknamed it Toilet to Tap. And there you go. And that's what it is. You know, that's what everybody calls it. It's a clever, cute name. It gets to the point. It scares people. You know, it does all the things, you know, that forever chemicals do. So, naming things is really important. Based on your CV and your history, it appears that you developed the patent on the treatment device in 2017. So when did you kind of become aware of this particular issue? Or I guess maybe the more interesting thing for me is, did you develop the treatment technology specifically for PFAS, or did you develop the technology realizing that, okay, as an advanced oxidation mechanism, it could treat many different things, and PFAS just became the one that, you know, you focused on?
Yeah, that's more it. You know, this is electrochemical oxidation. It's really it's just a different type of advanced oxidation technology. I find that it's much more versatile. It can do a lot. We fully automated it, so you don't have to, there's no chemicals to add or no brine produced. There's no, you know, there's really not, there's, it's pretty much touch free. But when I was in the lab and I was, again, going for a PhD at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and I was looking at electrochemistry. My background is in environmental engineering and environmental policy, and so I certainly didn't understand anything about electrochemistry, but here I am. So apparently don't either. I found that it could do a lot of things. It could just destroy ammonia. It was really good at disinfection. You know, there were so many opportunities out there that when I really decided that this was something I wanted to take and run with, PFAS, like I said, I found out about PFAS about 2010 or so when I started working for PA. And, right down the street from me at Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And I was actually talking with some of the airport down there and some people at the Firefighting Academy and just a lot of stakeholders that were having this issue with these PFCs, no PFAS. And I think that was in the back of my head, right? I really wanted to try and solve that problem. And it wasn't until, so I filed the patent in 2016. I spun the company out in 2017. 2018 was the first time that we actually had PFAS. We were starting to do PFAS tests. And it was proven in the literature that electrochemistry could destroy PFAS, but we really helped develop that, really helped to put it out there and make it a reality, prove that we're breaking these compounds down and not just forming short chain compounds. And here we are today.
So when you say destroy, so you're breaking the bond. So what ends up being the, you know, the conjugates of the compound at the end of, you know, once it's oxidized?
So PFAS is mostly made of carbon and fluorine. The carbon, almost all of it goes to CO2. The fluorine, most of it goes to free fluorine, F-. We do form some hydrofluoric acid. It's, you know, at very low concentrations. If we're at nanograms per liter of PFAS starting, we're only generating nanograms per liter of hydrofluoric acid. It's really not much to change the pH. And so that's where the majority of it goes. And we've really tried to close that mass balance and really try to figure out if we have a starting concentration of, you know, call it 100 nanograms per liter, where does it all go? And we've closed the majority of that circle, but we actually ended up generating more free fluorine than we had, which likely means that some of the fluorine is sticking to the components inside of the reactor. So anyways, I'm getting a little bit deep into that, but it's really, really important to understand those byproducts.
Right, because that's as you treat anything, you know, there's, it doesn't go away. It just becomes something else. Mm-hmm. And then are those reactive chemicals or not? And since there's no brine, it's staying in the liquid. So if it's drinking water, those components still stay there. You know, they're not necessarily going away or out of the water stream, I don't think. And so it's, I think it's important for people to understand as you're looking at treating these recalcitrant chemicals, you know, what happens to the byproducts. So that's what I was curious about, you know, okay, this goes here, this goes there. So I'm glad to hear that you found most of the fluorine, you can account for most of it in your mass balance. So that's a good thing.
It's really good. It's really, really important because, right, we don't want to just be taking compounds and turning them into other, you know, other PFAS compounds. Now, we do generate a little bit of them. You know, we had some studies done by Arizona State University and some other third parties. And, you know, we asked the question, can we really truly use the destruction word? And they said, yeah, absolutely. which was really neat. You know, it's, in some of the studies we've seen, specifically in the ASU studies, between 93% and 98% destruction of PFAS chemicals, meaning that we only formed, you know, anywhere between, you know, 3% and 7% of small chain, which is just a tiny fraction of the entire byproduct.
Which of the states, you know, when I did my research, it didn't seem like the EPA had set any, you know, drinking water standards. Are any of the states leading in the regulation of these compounds?
Yes, there are definitely states that are leading. There are more states, of all of the ways that you can regulate PFAS, more states are regulating in drinking water. Massachusetts is one. There's a handful of them that have regulated it, actually in the state for drinking water. Michigan is taking an interesting lead in the regulation of PFAS, and they've actually regulated it in the discharge of wastewater. So it's permanent. It's regulated there. I think they're the only state to regulate it. And so that's actually really attractive. You know, it's really attractive for our clarity, because now we have companies who cannot discharge PFAS.
Are your customers from that perspective, are they more kind of industrial customers looking at the discharge side as opposed to municipal water treatment plants? Because I would think from a form factor perspective, you know, a 100 million gallon a day water treatment plant has got to be a difficult sell as far as, you know, running all of that water through an electrochemical process, whereas managing the discharge probably is maybe more effective, higher concentrations at that level, although maybe harder to treat because you got more stuff in the discharge. So where are you finding your customers, on the discharge side or the treatment or the water side?
So it's actually both. You're completely right in that the higher concentration of PFAS, the more PFAS we have in a smaller volume, the better. It's better in performance. It's better in cost. You know, we're really competitive there right now today. So if you look in the environment, where is it naturally concentrated? Well, a dead set home run for us is landfill leachate.
Oh,
now,
okay.
You can imagine everything nasty is in landfill leachate. But the PFAS concentration is really high. heard a lot of other stuff in landfills. There's ammonia, very high concentrations, BOD, COD, you know, so many other contaminants or groups of contaminants in there. What's quite interesting and something you touched on is that if we're treating concentrated PFAS, it doesn't matter so much if it's a quote-unquote clean or semi-dirty water or liquid waste, however you want to classify it. Very scientifically, the rate constant, basically how fast we degrade the compound, is fairly similar if it's more in dirty water or in the clean water. What matters most is the starting concentration, that, you know, the more concentrated, the better. Just real quick, from a scientific standpoint, this is really cool. I think it's so awesome. The PFAS sorb, they actually stick right onto the electrode and they're degraded there. Hmm. Whereas all the stuff in the water that gives it color is mostly degraded in the water itself, not at the electrode surface. Hmm. So there are separate reactions going on, and you have similar destruction of the PFAS if it's very dirty, or as opposed to if it's fairly clean water.
Oh, well, that's interesting. You know, as a mechanical engineer, I was always taught to keep electricity and water separate. And so I'm curious, do you find when you're talking to people about electrochemical processes that, you know, you get that kind of reaction? Because that's my initial reaction. It's like, you know, I don't want you zapping. I mean, I remember my wife's sister had a house, they had a swimming pool, they had an electrical short in one of the light fixtures under the water. And if you touch the water, you would get shocked. It's like, you know, my worst nightmare.
Yeah, we used to get questions like that all the time. How safe is this? You know, are you sure you should be doing that? The customers that we talk to now are they've heard of electrochemistry, they understand how it works, and really we actually haven't had that question in a long time. It's pretty cool. It's actually pretty cool that you brought it up. The same reason why it's not good for your family to touch the water short is actually why it works so well, because we're electrifying water. Now, that being said, if we were to touch the water, it's not enough power where it's going to zap anybody. But we're generating, it's like lightning, right? It's like we're taking advantage of the electrons that are generated right on the anode surface to break the carbon fluorine bond. That's right. What's effective.
Not so that's effective, sure.
Yeah, we're taking that. I guess I don't want to call it dangerous. It's not dangerous.
No, it's not dangerous. No.
We're taking advantage of what actually does happen when you put electricity in water. It's really good things.
Did you have any muses or mentors that either advised you to do something specific or advised you to not do something? I mean, there was anybody that said, oh, this is a crazy idea, you know, stay away from this. I'm always curious, you know, the people's influencers, you know, from their technical perspective.
Yeah, I can think of three off the top of my head, and I'm going to try and get through them quickly. the first notable one was actually a guy who I unfortunately haven't talked to in a while, but really highly regard. Anyways, his name is Nick Ganson, and he worked at Watts Water. Watts still works at Watts Water Technologies. And way back when I was spinning the company out, we were focused in destruction of bacteria and viruses, so disinfection, mm-hmm. and also PFAS destruction at the home, you know.
Oh, okay.
And I worked with Watts Water Technologies, and they funded some research and helped us to get our first prototypes out. And you know, Nick was a big mentor when it came, and he worked for Watts. He's advocating for us and to get us working with Watts. We ended up together deciding that going after the residential market wasn't really the best idea at first. It's certainly something that could be a fit in the future, but economics, you know, we need to focus so much on supply chain economics. And, you know, there were so many other hot opportunities that we should be going after. Another one who I still work with that I talk to a couple times a week, actually both of these other two, Chris Sims. Chris Sims is a managing partner at the Alchemy Fund, and he was his fund is one of the first investment groups to invest in Clarity. And Chris is just this like genius mastermind guy who can quite literally change the face of the company, or like the face, but like the inner workings of the company in a quick conversation. And he just, I don't know, he's just brilliant. I can't think of specific examples that we've run through scenarios and done strategy planning. And he's probably single-handedly helped me and the company over anybody else. And the third person, while I'm still talking, I have to do this, is Earl Jones. Earl is CEO of Heartland, Heartland Water Tech, and I've known Earl for many years through the industry. But he's again one of those people who has really helped me navigate the landfill space. Discuss so many so just opportunities, people management, go to market strategies, everything. And so I think it's really those three people I
cool.
own.
Right. Yeah, just to digress a little bit, I noticed in your CV that you were on the dance team in high school and college. I guess my wife performed and was a professional modern dancer for 10 seasons and still teaches and performs a little bit. And my daughter is in musical theater up in LA. So, you know, dance is near and dear to my heart. But I'm curious, you know, do you find any similarities between a dance performance and starting a technology company?
Oh my gosh. dance it's funny because it was a really big part of me. And I now have a daughter, she just turned 3, and she's actually in her 3rd year of dance. She was dancing before she could walk. So I can live vicariously through her. okay, but are there similarities? I think a lot of it has to do with improvising when you need to, having confidence to make the right decisions, and a lot of that is when you're performing, you just have to go out and dance fully with confidence, and a lot of that comes to running a business as well. And I actually find that when you're dancing, you're taught a step in one way, and then my old teachers used to say, okay, now reverse it. So let's say, like, if you're doing a step with your, and you start with your right foot, you do it, you do the whole thing, right, the whole routine, and then they would say reverse it. So you basically start with your left foot, and then you do everything else following the opposite side. And there's just so much like thinking you have to do in order to do that. And that's a lot. It's very similar to running a company. It's like, okay, what if we did it another way? Let's quick react, like quick mind body changes and pivots. And that's quite interesting.
Did you start the company, you know, by yourself as a one-woman show, or did you start with a team? And then I'm also curious about, you know, if you feel like there was kind of an inherent negative or positive bias to a female entrepreneur, especially in the water business, which is still predominantly a male kind of bastion, though it's changing, but still it's, you know, it's that is the case. But I was wondering how you started the company. Did you just, like I said, start with the team, and you know, from the fundraising perspective or just from the management perspective, you know, what was your you know, personal experience from the gender perspective?
Yeah, so I filed a patent at the university in 2016, decided to spin out the company in 2017, And then it was myself. I was looking for a co-founder. You know, I was a technical founder. I was going for a PhD in engineering, certainly the technical side. And I looked for a co-founder who was in the School of Business, getting an MBA. And so I did find a co-founder. And we worked together for 4 years. It was good 4 years. 4 years. The co-founder decided to leave after the fourth year. And so I've been a solo founder since then. And that was about a year and a half ago, which is pretty crazy. You know, I think there are certainly benefits to having a co-founder, in that you can bounce things off of that other person. They're you know, fairly equal to you. But I think there's also a you know, it's a give and take, right? But there's also a benefit in being a solo founder, in that you have the ability to make decisions pretty quickly. You don't have to go off of and based off of somebody else, and you have the, you know, the flexibility of being probably a little bit more creative, not so restrained. Mm-hmm. But that also means that if there's an issue or something going on, sometimes the team, as helpful as my team is, and they're fantastic people, but I find that every now and then, you know, everybody kind of just crosses their hands and looks at me. Julie, what do we do?
It's you.
And I have to have an answer. Mm. Right. I mean, sometimes it's, I'm not sure, I need to think about it, or so-and-so, or, and I need your help. Can let's figure this out. That's a challenge, but being a female, yeah, it certainly has its challenges. I joke because I've gone through two fundraising rounds now, venture capital fundraising rounds, and both times I was pregnant.
Oh, wow.
So actively fundraising while very pregnant. And so I've never actually fundraised without being pregnant. And it'll be interesting to fundraise and not be pregnant. my first time, I was very scared. And this was pre-COVID, so, you know, everything is in person. And, you know, I was definitely scared to go, you know, I flew out to Chicago, I flew out to San Francisco, you know, I did the whole like roadshow thing. And but it didn't matter, really. I think in a way it helped a lot, because it maybe weeded out some of the investors that didn't potentially feel like, you know, I don't know, I was capable, I suppose. I mean, two pregnancies later, and we're doing really well. But I can see it being a risk. But on the other hand, you just have to manage that risk just like anything else. And being a mom and hiring moms and working with other parents, I should not even say moms, parents in general, I find that parents have this amazing way of just being productive and managing their time.
And so, how many staff people do you have now?
Right now we have nine.
Nine
and a couple floating interns. So solid group, small group, but it's fantastic.
Is everybody in the same area? I mean, do you have everybody coming into the office, or are you distributed?
We're mostly in the same area. We have two remote employees. The rest are right here in Massachusetts. We do have an office right now in Hadley, Massachusetts, which is fairly west than the majority. We're mostly in the central Massachusetts area, and actually I've got one right in Boston. So we're in the process of moving our office and lab to central Mass.
So I know your company is fairly young, but I always like to ask people this, because I know every investor, before they even invest in a company, startup company, has the end game in mind, has the exit in mind. You know, have you thought about your exit, your end game? I mean, you know, are you looking to build a huge company and change the world? Are you looking to, you know, get to a certain level and sell out and start another company? What's your, you know, kind of what's your game plan for the arc of the company?
Great question. Something that I think about all the time. I don't have the crispest answer for you, and there are reasons for that. The PFAS issue just itself is massive, $30+ billion opportunity, right? If we own a sliver of that, we'll be a billion-dollar company. Now, it's not very common for technology companies like Aclarity to go public. I think we have the opportunity to go public, but what I'm doing right now is I'm laying the groundwork for an acquisition. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have partnership agreements with some companies, to be integrated into their portfolio and help, you know, go to market together and whatnot. But the end goal is to get these channel partners aligned so that I have an exit opportunity. But I would just love to see how far we can take it with PFAS and help to solve the problem.
Great.
That's my long-winded answer.
That's fine. Are you having fun?
I am having fun. Sometimes I'm jumping up and down with joy, and other times I put my head down and I'm pulling my hair out. And typically it happens about 5 times a day. Yeah. So here, there, everywhere. I'm built for this, though.
Okay.
I'm doing exactly what I should be doing. And pile kids on top of it. It's an absolutely insane life that I don't think anybody understands. but maybe my husband.
I hope so. I hope so.
So besides that, am I having fun? Yeah, absolutely. This is pretty awesome.
That's important. What do you have any advice you would give to somebody who is considering starting up a new technology company in the water space, or maybe another way to put it is, you know, what's something that you didn't know when you first started your company that would be advantageous for somebody looking to start a company to understand?
Yeah, great question. I think the first thing is it comes down to passion. There are going to be really high highs and really low lows. Sometimes you may wonder if you're going to have a business tomorrow, and other times you're going to think you're going to have employees calling you asking what they should do if we're acquired. Like ASAP, right? So it's all over the place. So you've got to have that passion. And so on those low days or low hours, you got to pick yourself up and keep going. Also, there are so many resources out there to... sounding boards. It's just, I have really, one of the things I think is my superpower is like finding people and bouncing ideas off of those people and trying to weed out, but really get really, really good data points to measure decisions about measure them with and take those people along with you on your journey. HR is definitely the most difficult part of running a business. It took me quite a while to learn how to manage people, and I would still say I'm not that. I think my employees would say that they like working for me, but it's hard. It's a really hard thing to do. It's hard to retain people. It's hard to come up with plans for incentivizing people. It's hard to understand if your employees are happy or not. It's a learning curve. I've never managed people before, but I enjoy doing it. But HR is very hard. Not from a process standpoint, but from a real day to day. Managing people is hard.
People is very hard. I always found that I was a much better technocrat than I was a people manager. Let's put it that way. So I can relate.
Yeah. And it's necessary. You got to do it. And if you're going to be the CEO of the company, you got to manage people. You got to like it.
You have to like it.
We're going to be miserable. I like it. I'm learning all the time. Yeah.
Well, that was great. I really appreciate you joining me today. It was a really interesting conversation, and wish you all the best. And, you know, hopefully it's not a cause and effect that you have to be pregnant to go fundraising again. Hopefully, you know, it's those two things are not joined at the hip, so to speak. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Paul. Really appreciate it.
Thank you all for listening. This podcast was brought to you by Astera with additional support from Imagine H2O. The producer is Anna Gagliardo. Theme music by Gabriella Gagliardo. Yes, this is a family affair. Your host is Paul Gagliardo. If you have any questions about this podcast or the series, please contact us at thewaterentrepreneur@gmail.com. And please follow us on Instagram. We hope to see you again next time.